Good evening, one and all. Yes, the start of another week, nearly the end of August. I'm telling you, time is whizzing through, and it does when you get older. The older you get, the quicker it goes, I'm telling you. But I am here, and so is my guest. I'm here. I was talking to my guest before the show started. We were all hunkered down the weekend in Connecticut and around on New England, thinking the hurricane was going to hit us, and turned out to be a little bit of a non-event. Rhode Island got hit a bit in Massachusetts and stuff like that, but here in Connecticut, nope. We hunkered down. We got all the supplies in. We got the batteries. We got the this. We got the that. But it was just like a bit of rain. And a small bit of wind, not too much, but just small. Anyway, we are here. I am here, and so is my guest. Now, obviously, doing the music shows on a weekend, especially those are the days which basically is the 20th century, and I think 1904 was something the oldest we've gone back to in that. I have always been one into music. And, you know, I remember singing solos in the church choir and in a concert or two and stuff. And then when I went to my senior school, I studied music. I took music and always had a sort of understanding, shall I say, of the classics. In fact, I think the only thing I don't like is modern jazz, which I basically can't understand. Apart from that, it's like getting in the music. And I was watching something on YouTube the other day. Somebody was asking, because you can't have it anymore because it's jingoistic, The Last Night of the Proms, which we always used to watch every year. And I was thinking, well, I don't know, you know, I can remember Sir Malcolm Sargent, Flash, I think his nickname was, as a conductor doing some, and Sir John Barbarolli perhaps. But when you think of conductors, Sir Malcolm Sargent is the one that comes back to me, you know, as a person from England. But when you look on a global stage, especially in America, there is one other person that comes back, or that people will name when they sort of go through memorable conductors. Well, my guest can tell us a bit about that, because she's done, you know, we've got this in the past where somebody's taken over from their mother or what have you and finished that book off. Well, my guest today, she's sort of not just finished the book off, she expanded it as well to sort of bring in some of her bits to it. Better introduce her, haven't I? Because on the shows today, I have the one and only Lucy Antic Johnson. Hi, Lucy. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm fine. Thank you. How are you?
I am okay. I think that's the best best I can say. I've been doing some physiotherapy. That's run out of visits now, and I'm a bit worried that I'm going to go backwards with the old back trouble. But never mind. I'm here, and you are here, which is the important thing. As I said, I'll just talk about you first a bit. Like your father, you were into music a bit. You ended up looking after children's programs on CBS. There's a bit of a change there, isn't there, on along your pathway?
Well, it's a pathway that had many, many stops along the way. I, as a young person, as a child, I studied music because I came from a musical home. And I studied art very seriously because my mother was also an artist.
Oh, right.
And then I got fascinated by ballet when I was a teenager and was accepted into the Balanchine School, School of American Ballet in New York. And so I covered many of the arts. But once I hit high school, I realized that I wanted, of all things, to go into television production.
Mm.
And I loved being behind the scenes. I loved it. I loved the idea of it, and I loved helping to create something. And so I lived in New York. I grew up in the city. And the first 10 years or so, I did a lot of production work in New York and on variety and drama and sitcom, because that was still the era when so much was being produced in the city.
Right.
And then we all went out to Los Angeles, in the mid-80s, because that's where the business went.
Yep.
And I stayed in it. I loved what I was doing. But then I expanded and wanted to try and got accepted as being a big shot network executive.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, I worked in daytime, which is soaps and games and talk, and I did children's programming, and I did special events, and I did variety specials and primetime specials. I really did quite a few things and produced a movie
for
television. So I just loved being part of the production team, whether I was the executive producer or the assistant to the executive producer.
Right.
I worked my way up, and so it was, no, I didn't end up directly in the arts as my parents were, but they cheered me on. My mother certainly cheered me on, and that's how I got there.
I always say that, you know, it's like a creative gene, whether you're it's music, whether it's art, whether it's sculpture, you know, in your case, you know, creating, television productions, etc. It's a gene that allows you to create no matter what the media is. And, you know,
right.
And you're a prime example of that, obviously.
I think you're right. I just love creating things. And someone had once asked me what, you know, if and when you retire, what would you do? People always say, what do you do when you retire? And I said, I'm not so sure what it would be, but I know I'd have to be creating something.
Right, indeed.
And
yeah.
Lo and behold, in the last 2 or 3 years, I wrote and created this book.
Right.
Because I am not a professional writer. I have worked with professional writers my whole career, whether it was on scripts or soap opera long-term stories,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. But so I was as much an editor and as a guide, but this time it was me at the computer. And so I guess that's a new craft or a new creative craft you can add to
that. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's just another feather in your cap sort of thing, which is great. But the thing is, it was some of it, as I said, was started by your father.
Yes.
And you sort of took it on, if you like, to the next level with your own responsive. Let's,
yeah.
Let's tell everybody first. This is, and I said about the conductor that most people in America, of course, that's Toscanini.
Arturo Toscanini.
And your book is This Was Toscanini, The Maestro, My Father, and Me. Because you knew him when your father, I guess, was playing with him. Your father, Samuel Antic, was playing with him.
He was a first violinist with the NBC Symphony, which was an orchestra created especially for Arturo Toscanini in 1937.
Wow.
When Toscanini was already 70, he took on this new endeavor and came to America, moved to America, and the orchestra lasted until Toscanini retired at 87.
Retired?
I know. And in 1954, and my father played with the orchestra through all those 17 years. And during those 17 years, my dad also became a symphony conductor himself and really held both positions for many, many years. But as a violinist, as a player in the orchestra under the legendary baton of Toscanini, who was at that point in classical music history one of the most famous people in the world.
Yes.
And that's like an unofficial title. And he was an icon, and he was, I guess these days you'd call him a rock star.
Right.
I mean, hundreds of thousands of people, because he worked around the world. He was in Italy. He lived in Italy. And he came to the United States over and over and over, and he went through Europe. And he would just crowds and crowds and crowds of people. He was, for his gift and his talent, he was, you know, the top classical musician of his age. And my dad was commissioned to write an article for a literary magazine in America and called the Saturday Review, which
yep.
is no longer
yep,
around. Yep. And he wrote the article called Playing with the Maestro that told interesting stories about the process of how they worked, but also the behind the scenes. What was it really like to work with this famous, famous, famous man? And a publisher came to him after that. It was very well received, and even the maestro enjoyed it. and said, would you expand this into a book? So that's what this book is. He wrote a few more chapters about different aspects of working with the maestro. And sadly, my dad died very young and very suddenly at 49 as he was on the rise of his career. And he never got to write the last chapter. And or what we would, for all we know, it would have been two chapters, but we were never quite sure what he would have written about, and we have speculation. But my mother took over the project, put the book together, and it was published posthumously to huge acclaim, rave reviews from colleagues, from critics, from music historians, from other musicians, because it was then and continues to be the only full-length narrative of, from a musician of what it was like to actually play in the orchestra for this exalted conductor. And to this day, it's still the only one of its kind. So it was published and very well received and very well. And it was embraced by the Toscanini family. Well, fade out, fade in, it's many years later, and it's been proudly sitting on my in my living room for all these decades. And in 2017, which was the 150th anniversary of Toscanini's birth, there were many new articles about him and books. And one of the books quoted, it was a biography, quoted passages from my dad's book because they still felt it was the prime example of what it was like to work with this genius, artistic, truly artistic genius. And when I saw that, it just hit me that absolutely it's time to reissue his words. His words were relevant. His words were timeless. Great art is timeless. Learning about great artists is timeless. And Toscanini still had what he accomplished as a musician was still something that would inform new musicians and new generations of classical music fans. So I made the decision to reissue his memoir. In a conjunction with that, I said, well, even though my dad had written it in the first person, he didn't talk much about himself. It was all in the service of talking about his experience with the orchestra. So I said, time to shine a spotlight on my dad and his illustrious career and our life together, our family life, which was impacted greatly by the maestro, certainly. And so I just sat down and started writing, and one thing led to another, and here we are. There's a book.
Exactly. And as it says, The Maestro, My Father and Me, which tells you through... through the maestro himself, and then what your father, which is great that you managed to bring that in, and of course how it affected your life as well growing up. And one thing that I noticed that a lot of people have said that stands out in your father's book is the honesty. It's not no sort of buttering up or covering cracks or anything like that. It's a very honest book, and I think that might well be why a lot of people like it, because to actually have an honest biography is something.
Just to say, by the way, it's not a biography. It's a intimate behind-the-scenes portrait of the maestro at a certain period of time in his career and my dad's career. And I would say, you could almost say it's like being invited into a master class of creative process with a great artist. And you're through my father's writing and through his honesty, as you so aptly point out, you're involved as though you're in the orchestra experiencing what they're experiencing through his conducting style, his approach to a score, which was rather unique, and his moods, his infamous moods. So the honesty is the rough side and the musical side of a very complicated and fascinating man.
Growing up, were you able to meet him and see your father play in some concerts?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
I was too young to attend. I was little. I was too young to attend the live broadcasts,
right,
which were broadcast each Saturday evening from Studio 8H. Now, that might ring familiar because that's where Saturday Night Live comes from.
Okay.
It was a studio at the NBC Studios in Rockefeller Center that was converted into a concert hall. And on Saturday nights, they would do the live broadcast. I was too young to attend, and so I would sit with my aunt and my cousin, and we'd sit and look at this big, bulky radio in our living room and listen to the live broadcast. I was allowed to stay up for that. And then I would soak up all the stories at breakfast the next day about how the music went and how the concert went. And just a little point of fact, for that debut concert, which was Christmas night, 1937, there were 1,400 available seats in this studio. Mm-hmm. And there were 23,000 requests for tickets.
Wow.
He was big time.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes.
And not, you know, all over the world, but he had become famous in America as well. And when RCA, who owned NBC, decided to create this orchestra for him, listen, they knew it would be a jewel in their crown of their schedule, their radio schedule, and also for their recording division.
Yeah.
Because those recordings became masterpieces.
Yeah.
That are still available. So
yeah.
I once went to... with my mom to a rehearsal way in the back so that we couldn't be seen. I was told to really keep quiet. But I never met him personally.
Right.
I never had the pleasure. I went to a lot of my dad's concerts when he became the conductor of the New Jersey Symphony.
Okay.
But that's kind of another chapter because I was at that point getting a little older.
Right.
And could participate a little more. But my greatest memories are the stories he would tell at the dinner table about his day in his rehearsal or the recording studio and his practicing. You know, hours would go by. He'd be behind closed doors in the living room rehearsing, playing his violin for an upcoming performance or recording session. So my memories are more from the home and rather than the actual concert hall.
Right. What sort of conductor was he? Wasn't he sort of very... He knew everything by heart, didn't he? The whole piece or pieces or something like
yes,
that?
Yes. He had a photographic memory.
Right.
And he knew, I think it's 120 operas and over 400 symphonic
works.
Oh,
my goodness.
By heart. But his credo, which he really stuck to, was... Play what is written, look to the score, do not memorize. Because when you look at the score, and even he kept whatever piece he was performing, he kept the score next to him during rehearsal that he would refer to all the time, because there was always some inspiration or some question or some way to interpret indication on the score might mean. He did not want the players to play from memory because they would not be the same heart.
Yep.
And another thing he said all the time was play with your hearts, not your instruments. So it was a very emotional experience for him, full of passion. And as my father writes, as tough as he could be on them, and he could be tough sometimes in his exacting way, it helped the players be even better musicians.
Right.
So they loved him, even for his moods, they loved him for it, because they rose to the occasion of what his standards, of what he was reaching for.
That's great, because as you say, you know, the person wrote it, they knew what they were writing when they wrote it. Just because you might interpret it a different way, that's not what it was written to be. As you say, you read manuscripts and you see sort of different things and you interpret. But really, you shouldn't interpret. You should just do what was told by the person who actually wrote
it. However, what's interesting about that is if there's a marking that says forte or pianissimo or something like that on a score, well, how loud is forte?
Yeah.
How soft is pianissimo?
Yeah.
That's where the conductor's interpretation, trying to honor the creator's work, but still it's an interpretation, like a director in a play with a writer's play, is there were words on the page, but how does the actor interpret them? How does the director interpret them? The conductor in this case is the director of interpretation, and that's the creative art that he or she contributes. And even the same piece that he might have played one year, a couple of years later, he might change the tempo a little bit, or he might accentuate something a little differently. But it wasn't a diversion. He wasn't doing it to satisfy his own creative needs. He was trying to constantly reach for what the composer had intended.
Right. Now, that's very, very true.
That was his signature, really, of what he was truly recognized for by his peers and by other conductors, was how his passion for trying to interpret the creator's compositions.
After the success of your what your father wrote, what sort of response have you had to this, as it now is, this was Toscanini, the maestro, my father and me. What sort of response have you had adding the extra parts about your father and your effects?
I'm thrilled to say that it's been very, very positive. It only officially came out a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
So just to mention that, although it's been available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble for a while, but in terms of the press or media or people having it in their hands, and some of the people who have seen it knew the original book, which was a work of art in its day, and they are saying that they're enjoying this even more because I made it that much more personal. I introduce each of his original chapters with an essay that shines a spotlight on my dad, tells a little more about my recollections of growing up in that era, in my home, but also leads the reader into the chapter that they're going to read.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want to call too much attention to my story, but I use my story in a way that captivates the reader to want to keep going.
Right.
I've gotten fabulous reaction because people are actually moved by what I wrote.
Oh, that's great.
I'm not saying that in a coy way.
Right.
I'm just, you sit at the computer or the typewriter or with a yellow line pad, however mm-hmm. you choose to write, and you're alone.
Yep.
And then you start, all right, then you get an editor, and then you get a designer, and they fix a sentence here, and you fix a sentence there. But basically, you're alone in the process, and now you send it out into the world. And I'm thrilled to say that people have said that they are, how intimate the whole book feels, not just what the words that my father wrote, which has its own intimacy
mm-hmm.
for his experience, but then what I share and how I incorporated what my experiences into his work.
Right.
So it's a real blend. And
that's great.
Had we planned it, we couldn't have done it better.
Right. That's great. What was your father's favorite piece of music that he liked playing? Can you remember? Or did he have one?
Well, I'm not sure I actually know that answer. I know that they all loved working on and recording and performing the Beethoven symphonies.
Right.
That was an absolute favorite. And I also then think about his work with the New Jersey Symphony, and which he had favorites as well. But definitely I would think the Beethoven. I can't tell you why. And each piece that they did perform. Well, actually, there's a whole chapter in the book
mm-hmm.
that is a bar-by-bar journey that my dad takes the reader through Weber's Oberon Overture.
Uh-huh.
And for a musician, it's a feast because they're getting the actual, as though Toscanini is standing there exclaiming and explaining what he wants from each bar of music and how exacting he was and so forth. For a fan or someone that isn't that familiar with music, it's very entertaining. You may not know all the musical jargon, but you're entertained by the way it's written.
Isn't that a horn solo or something like that?
An opening.
Oh, here you go. I don't know where I dragged that bit of memory from.
And so I don't know whether that was my dad's favorite.
Right.
But he obviously favored it because he spends a whole chapter on
going
on
through it. Yeah.
Going step by step by step through it. And, you know, you talk about the horn solo is what opens the overture. And the son of the horn player and I have become friendly.
Oh, there you go.
This whole new generation, not new, but next generation of the children of have now found each other again. And that horn player was this new friend's father, the Burve brothers.
That's good. It's been fascinating chatting to you. I just checked the time. I didn't realize how quickly it's gone. It always goes quickly when you're enjoying having a good chat. But what I'm going to do now, as we're coming towards the end, is hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where people can find out more about you and, of course, the book.
Well, thank you. There is a website. And no surprise, the name is thiswastoscanini.com. And in there, you'll see my bio and different aspects of some reviews and some interviews that I've had. And it's available Amazon and Barnes & Noble online. And if it's not in your local bookstores now, just ask for it. They'll order it for you. We're just rolling out the deliveries and to the bookstores and the libraries around the country.
Well, that's great. It sounds like this is going to be, after your father's success, another success this time for you. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Well, thank you, Barry, and good luck to you. I look forward to – I hope I can listen to your program one day.
Okay, thank you.
Well,
there you go. My guest today, really interesting, Lucy Antek Johnson, LucyAntek and JohnSon. Lucy Antek Johnson. And we've been talking about her book and her father's book, if you want to sort of put it like that. This was Toscanini, The Maestro, My Father, and Me. Really interesting. Not just the fact that it, you know, covers one of the greatest conductors of the 20th century, without any shadow of a doubt, in Toscanini, but also the bit that her father wrote and how she's now brought in, Lucy's brought in about her father and about the effect on her. Everything in one, so really good. And as she said, a lot of people are already sort of saying what a brilliant piece of work it is. Well, that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow with another guest, but until then, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget, make sure it's working.